on kind of asking Doug kind of what he thinks should be the conservative response to climate change. And then the thing that you both know I'm really interested in
is the question of what's going to do, right? And how, and I'll probably talk a little bit about how for a long time I've been like carbon taxes
Okay. Good morning, everybody. Happy final day of the festival. Thanks for coming out. I assume everyone saw there's coffee in the back. I'm David Leonhardt. I'm a columnist at the New York Times. I see some familiar faces here. I've been moderating panels at the festival for a while. We're at the end of what seemed to be a really successful festival this year. And we're going to wrap it up now with a topic that I know is really very much on people's minds, both because of its import and because of what a big role it is playing in our political dialogue, including in the campaign, if you watch the debates this week. I was really disappointed 4 years ago about how few questions my fellow journalists asked in the presidential debates about climate change, and I was encouraged to see that it played a bigger role, at least so far, in this year's conversation. And we have two wonderful people to talk with us about this today. As usual, we're going to talk among the three of us, and then we're going to open it up to all of you for some questions. So sitting directly to my left is Rihanna Gunn-Wright, a former Rhodes Scholar. Are you a former, or are you always a Rhodes Scholar?
Always a Rhodes Scholar.
I think you're always
a Rhodes Scholar. are you a Rhodes Scholar, Doug?
I am not.
I am not either. So we have at least one on the panel. Our average Rhodes Scholarship on this panel is one-third. Rihanna is currently the policy director of New Consensus, and with New Consensus helped write the Green New Deal. So we're really lucky to have one of the really shapers and developers of it here with us today. Doug Holtz-Aiken is the president, founding president of the American Action Forum, which is a center-right think tank in Washington. He has also been the head of the Congressional Budget Office, the analytical arm of Congress that is supposed to look at things dispassionately. He's part of a long line of really impressive economists from both parties who have held that job. Over his long career, he served as the economic policy director for John McCain's 2008 presidential campaign. So we'll get right to it. So Rihanna, can you just give us some sense for what the purpose of the Green New Deal is? And the way I would think about it is, how is it supposed to succeed where policy attempts to address climate change have not before?
So how many of you have heard of the Green New Deal? Oh, wow. So that is actually isn't usually the case. How many people have actually read the resolution? Okay, fewer. Gotcha. So the Green New Deal is a proposal to tackle what we at New Consensus call the twin crises of the climate crisis and income inequality. And the place where it's supposed to succeed, I think it's different both ideologically in some ways and then politically. So ideologically, I think it's meant to really start to ask questions about how can we make the economic transformation that is coming when we're shifting from fossil fuels? Because when you change your energy source, you change everything. So it will be an economic transformation, whether we plan for it or not that way. So if it is coming, how do you design it so that everyone benefits? Because historically in the U.S., when we do these sort of big transformations or really everyday things, the progress is on the backs of the same types of people over and over and over again. And so we wanted to say, how is there a way to solve these crises without making someone's life, body, dignity, the price for progress, which is generally how we do. What does it mean? Can you design that so that those trade-offs aren't as salient? And then I think the other thing that it was supposed to do politically is really bring together, knit together for people what climate what the climate crisis will actually mean for them and how it will affect their daily lives. And so it's really about widening our sort of consideration of climate, really thinking about the ways that this next sort of iteration of the American economy can work for everyone, and then using that sort of knitting together to build a coalition that is strong enough to push forward aggressive climate policy.
And is the main fear in terms of a climate solution could be done on the backs of people, is the main fear that energy taxes are regressive, and so that energy taxes would hit lower income communities harder?
I mean, that's part of it, but it's far bigger than that, right? We're talking about so much work that needs to be done. So I think the real motivating fear is when these new jobs come, when it shifts, will these communities not have access to those jobs? Will they not be able to turn that income into wealth? Will they still be treated as dumping grounds for pollution, right? And for whatever sort of negative effects come from the transition, because none of these are like clean, easy. All of the solutions get your hands kind of dirty, right? Whether even renewables, you're talking about mining, right? For minerals, you're talking about all sorts of, I mean, solar panels right now, it takes an enormous amount of water to make solar panels, right? So we're thinking about all of those things. So the motivating factor is really like, in 50 years after we have done that, will we look around and will the black unemployment rate still be double the average unemployment rate, which it has been for decades, right? Will communities of color still have above average air pollution levels, right? Will communities still not be able to pay for energy and water, right? So these are the motivating factors. When we look forward, will the distribution of power remain the same?
Doug, I know you have some concerns about the Green New Deal. Talk to me about what you like about it and what your concerns are about it.
Yeah, let me say a couple things about it. First, I think everyone in this room should read the resolution. It's 14 pages and worth your time. Because second, I just want to congratulate Rihanna and her colleagues on the attention that they have managed to bring to this issue. It's all those hands went up. That was fantastic. I wrote my first paper on climate change in the late 90s as an academic, did studies at the Congressional Budget Office 2003-04-05 on the McCain campaign. We had a cap-and-trade proposal, as did soon-to-be President Obama. To my eternal dismay, the fact that we both had proposals meant that no one talked about them. Like, they only talk about what's different in the candidates. So, you know, I've never seen anything like the attention that this has garnered. And I think that's a really good thing. Third thing I'd say about it is no one should be opposed to the objectives of the Green New Deal. It wants to have a clean environment, health insurance for people, housing, food, jobs, these are all utterly unobjectionable goals. And so the only thing comes down to, is this the best way to get there? Because all of the things that the Green New Deal tries to shoot for are things that we should all be in favor of as a country. There's no doubt about that. So my concern has always been, you know, the combination of policy and politics, can you get it done? And, you know, probably my biggest single concern, critique, and I'd be curious to hear why you did it this way, is to me, it really carves into two things. There's a green thing, which is very much about climate change, greenhouse gases, and the transition to a different sustainable energy system. And then there's a New Deal, right, which is single-payer health insurance, free college, housing guarantees, guaranteed jobs, an array of things. That seems to me too much, and I would not have done that. So I'm just curious why.
Yeah, I think for us it was really thinking about, well, I think I'll start from the fact that for many people, the green part and the New Deal part are not experienced separately in their everyday lives. So, for example, so I grew up on the south side of Chicago, and black communities, I think it's like at least 50% live within 30 miles of a coal-fired power plant, so the air quality is worse. And I, in fact, did have asthma as a kid that disappeared when I moved. But the fact is, like, when you're talking about climate change, right, for someone like in my community, if we are just talking about decarbonization, they don't, what does that mean? You're talking about solar panels. How does that connect to my life? You know, I don't have access to childcare. I'm working multiple jobs to make ends meet, et cetera. But when you start having a conversation about when it's getting hotter, that is cooking the pollution, and that's giving your baby asthma attacks. And when your baby has asthma attacks, they go to the hospital. You have to take off your shift job, which means that you might be in danger of not getting another shift, and you have to stay with your child. Now your child has days, regular days out of school, so their educational outcomes are going to be worse, right? And on top of that, now your inhaler costs $240 per inhaler. If you have a child with chronic asthma, you go through inhalers like that. I don't know what my mother would have done if my inhaler cost $240 every time I needed a new one, right? So when we start talking about it like that, people are like, oh, okay, this, I see how this is impacting my life. I see the trail. I didn't understand it now. And now I can also start to see where I can intervene. So if we can get it, you know, less hot, what does that mean? And so that's where we want it to start. We want it to bring it down to a level where people could engage. And then the second part is the economic transformation. So the Green New Deal is structured as an economic mobilization, which means essentially we're saying put the full force of the U.S. government as well as the private sector to this problem, and there's a ton of work to get done. So the Green New Deal outlines like a super grid. It outlines that we have to decarbonize transportation, all of these things. And we did it like that because that we wanted to design it around buckets of work. What sort of work needs to be done? So let's move it away from the abstract of we need to get through down to this many parts per million, these technical solutions. What is the work that will be done? How will it show up for everyday Americans? And so when we do that, we realize that like everyone, because our economy is not on equal ground, because our workforce can be incredibly fractured, especially along racial, socioeconomic lines, when you have that work, if you are intervening in those structures, everyone will not have access to those jobs. Everyone will not have access to the abundance that, you know, that we at least hope even just an energy will be created, right? Everyone will not be able to participate. So again, that same woman, she might be on Medicaid because despite the fact that there's a smaller provider network, Medicaid is among the most comprehensive insurance that you can get. But if she takes a higher job, she will fall out of Medicaid and her job might not provide health care. So what, she's in a, between a rock and a hard place. Do I keep this bad job, right, and not have health and have healthcare for my kid, or do I not? And so these are the sorts of things that we were thinking about, as well as the fact that like this is going to be a transition, even with a carbon tax, right? Carbon cap and trade, those can create disruptions in the economy, disruptions in the workforce. And so it's no one's fault that we waited this long to deal with climate change, except our leaders. Everyday Americans should not have to pay the price for that. And so those parts are also in there to soften the transition so that as the economy is moving, as it is shifting, people have some support, because right now we know that our safety net is inadequate for the circumstances we have now, much less the circumstances that come when climate change gets worse.
My reading of it is that the Green New Deal is neutral on the idea of carbon taxes and cap and trade.
It is.
Right? It does not, they're not in there, but they're also not against it.
Yeah.
I have a question about where climate policy has been, but Doug, first, is there any way in which you want to respond to the kind of discussion of the pairing of the green?
It's helpful.
So I think one of the critiques from the right and from the kind of old centrist Democrats, I shouldn't say old, but for, you know, I mean, I say old just because it was, these were Democrats who had the levers of policy for the most part in prior Democratic administrations, is that it's not politically realistic, the Green New Deal. And so I guess one thing, let's set aside for a minute whether people think it's politically realistic. I feel like the critics need to grapple with the political unrealism of the solutions that they, and I've often been pushing them, so I should say we, have been pushing, which is a carbon tax or a cap and trade, the idea that economists like, which is we say pollution is bad, we're going to put a price on it. If you put a price on it, people will use it less. The incredible power of the free market will then push us toward less carbon intensive, cleaner energy. I believe every word I just said. It's also the case that we haven't gotten that done. And so I guess, Doug, one thing I want to ask you is, given that the idea of a carbon tax, Americans hear it and they hear tax, right? They're struggling with slow growing incomes. They hear tax. They say, no, thank you. Given that, it's not that popular. And also, it hasn't actually, part of the design of a carbon tax was it was supposed to be a compromise between the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, with notable exceptions like your late boss, John McCain. The Republican Party has shown no interest in it. And so how do you see that a kind of climate solution that you favor, how does it ever happen?
Well, it hasn't so far, so I have no good answers to that. Let me first say what I think is the gold standard for what conservatives ought to be doing on this, and then talk about the politics. The gold standard is really simple. This will be successful only if the United States leads. This is not something that the United States can do alone. It is going to have to be a global effort, and I don't think that happens without genuine U.S. leadership. We're not going to join into something that everyone else decided to do. It's going to take leadership. We will only provide that leadership if we do something that is perceived to not be horribly damaging to the United States, because what if people don't join? We just damaged ourselves and not solved the problem. So I'm in favor of a very particular form of a carbon tax, which is the one that the research literature shows works, and that is a revenue-neutral carbon tax where you take the carbon tax revenues and you use it to cut payroll and corporation and other income taxes, whatever it may be, thereby not raising the total tax burden, providing the incentives to mitigate greenhouse gas emissions. You also would get rid of the regulatory state that's attached to it. The Clean Air Act shouldn't be aimed at carbon. It's an inefficient way to do it. So you clean that stuff up. That's where you have to go. Now, why can't that happen? One, my guys have demonized the carbon tax. To my eternal dismay, there's this fundamental incoherence on the right which says the free market is the most powerful thing the globe has ever seen. It responds in a flexible fashion to different incentives and creates all sorts of new technologies, but a carbon tax would stop it dead. It's an incentive. It's a price incentive. It'll work. I mean, this is the most intellectually incoherent thing I've ever heard. There's no reason why we can't have a carbon tax and have a rapidly growing innovative economy. So that's been a problem. Second thing that I think has been a problem is it really has been an issue of the elites. The average American for a long time has heard about climate change, vaguely thinks that it's a bad thing, but they haven't voted on this. And, you know, John McCain got a vote on a cap and trade proposal in the U.S. Senate, and those who went with him on the Republican side paid for it. And so they've run away from this. There's no doubt about it. And now they're in a place where they're talking about innovation only as a way to deal with this. I don't think that'll get there. And the third is, you really do have to get this done in a bipartisan fashion. There is no way around that. And we are at a nadir of bipartisanship and have been for about a decade. So I'm quite nervous about all of that.
And what do you think could change it so there would be Republican votes for any plan to attack climate change, whether it's carbon tax, cap and trade, or
whatever.
Anything.
Right. So it's been my working hypothesis for a while now that for the foreseeable future, and you get to define what that is, you will not get a favorable vote on a standalone carbon policy in the House, the Senate, and have a president sign it. It'll have to be part of some other thing. And the other thing, this one reason I was curious why they bundled it the way they did, I do think you have to bundle it. I thought the bundle was tax reform. I really thought you would, you know, have Republicans who wanted to get tax rates down, get the corporate rate down in particular, and they would need another revenue source. The carbon tax would be that revenue source, so you would drag them grudgingly to support it. Democrats wouldn't want the corporate cut, but they'd like the carbon policy. You drag them to that, and you get a coalition of the disgruntled pass this thing through. But tax reform turned out to be Republican only, done with special procedures, and that moment passed. And I think that's a loss.
So, Rihanna, I know you have substantive concerns about a carbon tax, even beyond my political concerns, right? I'd love to snap my fingers and have a carbon tax, but I think you have more substantive concerns. And so can you talk a little bit about that? And I guess to me, particularly the version of the carbon tax that we've had a bunch of people come out in favor of, it's a version that if you were watching the debates or read about the debates, John Delaney, who was in the first night, who's sort of the most centrist Democrat in the race, I know he is in favor of, which is basically, it's a version of what Doug was just talking about, which is you pass a carbon tax, you take all the money, all of it that the carbon tax raises, and you return it to the American people in some relatively progressive way, so that on a percentage basis, someone making $30,000 or $50,000 a year gets more of the revenue back than someone making $200,000 or $2 million. What are your concerns?
Yeah. They get the same amount back, but it hurts them less because they have a lower footprint. Everybody gets the same.
You know, on a percentage basis, they get more at 30 and 50 of their income.
Oh, thank you. Just what everybody gets back.
Yeah, so I think our main concerns have come from our conversations with climate justice activists and environmental justice activists, which is largely that one is the structure of the dividend. And that's, I think, a easily solvable problem. But often we're hearing about a dividend that's paid back around tax time. But the fact is you're changing prices in
monthly before they see the
prices.
Sorry.
There are some that do that. There are others that don't. But I think
we'll get to questions.
Which is fine. You can do it monthly as well. But the fact is that a lot of folks are really nervous that prices are going to rise, right, in their real lives, and there will be a delay between the funds that they need to live and when they get the money. The other, I think, deep fear is that corporations will find a runaround around it the way that they have with cap and trade, where you have these creation of pollution hotspots. And people are really hurt by those. So I think that's another one. And then I think the last really deep fear about pricing is that we will spend up all of our political capital fighting for a carbon price that is adequate, right? Because, I mean, there was a fight for California, and it's $15 a ton. I think the IPCC report, the minimum bound is $250 per ton, that we will use up all of our capital fighting for that, and there will be none left for the rest of the provisions if that even passes.
Okay. As I read the alternative to a carbon tax or cap and trade, and I'm phrasing this not in the form of a question, but it is a question, meaning correct what I'm getting wrong here. I read the alternative.
Oh,
yes.
Sorry, the other fear is that carbon tax focuses so much on carbon and doesn't pay attention to other criteria pollutants, which is really what is hurting frontline communities or the things that they are really worried about.
Meaning the stuff that causes asthma, but
the
not
stuff
climate
that causes asthma. Yeah.
Doug.
So just a couple of things on this, thought about this. I'm not a big fan of this proposal to return it all in the form of these dividend checks. If you think about it, those dividend checks are another government spending program. They're another entitlement. You're entitled to this. We have a federal budget that is fundamentally broken and can't afford another entitlement. I mean, that I think would be an enormous mistake. It is not possible, as a matter of sort of the mechanics, to actually find everybody who deserves a check and get it to them every month in advance on time. There's this old proposal called the fair tax, which had the same structure. We just can't do that administratively, so it's not going to work out that way. I also think that if you do it right, this fear of the price increase is mistaken. If you put the carbon tax in and you take out other taxes, you're taking costs out of the system to begin with, so you don't need to have price rises to accommodate all of them. If you cut the payroll tax, after-tax incomes are going to be much higher. Take-home pay is higher as well. So you want the price of carbon-intensive goods to rise. That's the point. But that doesn't mean that broadly you're going to have a big inflation out of this. It's going to hurt people disproportionately.
And you're saying money is fungible. So rather than cut people checks, just say you're paying more taxes here, you're paying less taxes here.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess what's interesting to me about that is that to some extent your concerns are about trust in government, right?
A bit, and about delivery mechanisms.
And so part of what I wonder is, I agree with you that a lot of people are going to look at a carbon tax and kind of, am I really going to get it all back? Even in your version, right? They're going to say, well, wait a second, I didn't get it all back, right? And so if part of what you're concerned about is trust in government, how do you get the kind of faith in government that would be needed to make the Green Deal succeed, Green New Deal succeed?
So I think that's also part of where the equity part is coming in. So people are afraid, but we have found that when you are talking about this as as sort of a holistic thing, and you are talking about, so if you read the resolution, there's language about systemic inequality, there's language about clean air, clean water, right? There's language about essentially not building this next mobilization on the backs of folks who have traditionally been marginalized. And when people hear that, they hear, oh, you see me. Oh, you see what I am going through. Oh, you are committed to a version of America that I have wanted my whole life. And so that helps dissuade, because when you are just talking about a carbon tax, you're asking people again to say, okay, here's another financial mechanism. We'll trust that the banks or whoever won't, or the government in this case, but a lot of people don't when they hear, you know, the financial industry is very complicated. So people get confused, but they hear, oh, okay, this is just another technocratic thing. Maybe I'll get a check, maybe I'll get a pay cut, but this doesn't say anything about the kind of America that I want to live in or that I want my kids to be part of.
It does seem to me, Doug, that if you look at the recent political economic history, the idea that a spending program where we say, hey, we're going to spend money doing research for clean energy, we're going to spend money creating good jobs in clean energy, there are really good reasons to believe that that is more politically feasible,
yes,
more politically realistic than a carbon tax or cap and trade. Aren't there?
Oh, I don't disagree with that. But they will not ultimately address what is going to have to be a global policy problem. And so they'll be good, it'll be better, but it's not a solution. If you're genuinely concerned about climate change, you have to think bigger.
And you're saying a carbon tax is because it creates a framework that China and India and the EU could join.
Yes, and you can layer onto it all sorts of incentives. You should border adjust a carbon tax so that carbon-intensive imports have an extra tax on them and vice versa. You can have that be on a sliding scale so that those who adopt a climate policy, you know, have a lower barrier. And, you know, there are lots of ways to, I think, to do that, but you need the whole world. And, you know, we pulled out of the Paris Accord, that, you know, there have been these other attempts, but they weren't real. We need something real.
And in the Green New Deal version, what's the vision for how we get China, the EU, India, etc.
I think it's multifaceted. So I did want to say the first thing is that internationally we've already seen countries start to like build their own Green New Deals or want to build them or want to pass them. And so I do think that it has international appeal. I think one of the things about the Green New Deal that the hope, well, not the hope, but the intention is that when it's shown that America is taking a real leadership role and has a real vision, it will signal that we are taking real leadership and we will actually have the grounds upon which to actually start talking about climate. And then I think, so that's one part of it. I think the other part is taking a leadership role in trying to decarbonize as quickly as possible and therefore showing good faith to developing nations that we are not intending to do this on their backs. We are not intending to spend up the carbon budget ourselves and then leave them very little room for economic growth because they still need more economic growth to raise the standard of living, that we are in fact taking that seriously and we are in fact taking a leadership position, leading the world in the ways that we say that we want to lead the world. And then I think the third rail around which I think will be trade and trade agreements and thinking about them from the lens of a Green New Deal. But I will admit the Green New Deal is largely a domestic policy. It is about getting America to a place where we are leading, right? And we have a vision of our economy that we want and that we're working towards, and then we can step back and say, what kind of international agreements do we want, right? And how do we want, how can we encourage the rest of the world to move in this direction? So I will not say it's not a policy designed for like immediately for a global framework, but rather to sort of put our money where our mouth is, to the point that it gives other countries the sense that we are serious about this problem and that we are going to lead on it.
Two last questions, and then I'll open it up to you all. So, Doug, the first, mostly for you, But to me, there's a way in which the Green New Deal is deeply consistent with American history. And I don't mean all the specifics, some of which I like, some of which I like less. But I mean this notion that if we're asking the country to make a fundamental transformation, as you've said, Rihanna, we can't keep the idea of everyday living standards for ordinary people secondary. It has to be primary. And the main historical example I'm thinking of is World War II, in which, as part of the big mobilization, the country very clearly expanded the role of labor unions in the economy. And it was basically saying, hey, we are asking you guys, this country, to mobilize for war, and essentially we are, as we do it, we're going to lift your pay as well. Right? And it would be easy to look back and say, well, why are you worrying about labor unions? We got to beat the Nazis. And essentially, the Roosevelt administration understood, I think, that beating the Nazis involved making sure that people felt good about their everyday lives. And I guess I worry that the kind of climate solutions that you and I, as much as we may disagree on other things, have liked in the past, similarly to the issue of trade, put secondary the kind of everyday living standards, and that whether it's a carbon tax or something else, it has to include the kind of direct attempts to help people's lives that the Green New Deal includes. Do you think I'm wrong about that, or do you think I'm right, but you'd like to see it in a somewhat different way than the current proposal does?
The thing I think you're right about, we'll use the trade analogy.
Great. Right?
Trade agreements have been good for the United States and for the populace. It's indisputable. Two things come up, however. Number one, Americans, there's a trust issue. They don't believe those trade agreements are actually being enforced. And so there's a genuine trust issue that I think people like me who are in favor of trade agreements need to address on the enforcement side, so they're real. And the benefits of them are broadly dispersed, and no one can see what the Korea free trade agreement did for them. And there are people who are hurt by trade. It's an indisputable fact, and they have, in the U.S., traditionally not been helped to adjust to those harms. And so if you think of a climate policy in the same way, if it has those characteristics, broad benefits, not easily discerned, some people who are visibly hurt, and the belief that, hey, they're gaming this somehow, it's not going to work. So your focus is on the direct benefits. Those are politically more palatable. That's why the dividend proposal, I think, has gotten some attention, despite my reservations about it. I think that directness, that linking, does have to show up in the politics of it, or it's not going to go forward.
Okay. Anything you want to add, or should I get to my last question?
No, you can get to it.
Okay. So I think I can't decide whether this is optimistic or horribly pessimistic. But I think
I'll take the other side, whichever it is.
Fair enough. I think the thing that has the most likely to change the politics of climate change in this country is the weather. And I think for a long time, people, scientists, journalists have said, no, we can't talk about the weather with climate change because we can't blame any one storm on climate change. I think that's wrong. I agree we can't blame any one storm on climate change. But the thing about the climate change is that it changes the climate, right? And so we already see this. The Wall Street Journal recently has had a lot of very good stories from the Midwest about small towns where bridges have closed and routes to the grocery store that used to take 10 minutes this summer take 90 minutes. Obviously, there are many places like New York and Houston and New Orleans that have already suffered serious damage from climate change. My reading of the science is that those things are going to become more frequent, not less. I think it's deeply pessimistic because we're basically talking about harm to this country and to our citizens and to people around the world. But it seems to me that now has the best chance of changing the politics of climate change and making something, whether it's carbon tax or the Green New Deal or something else, politically feasible. Do you agree, Rihanna, that the weather has a chance to change the politics of climate change? And do you see anything else that I don't that could also fundamentally change the politics of climate change?
Yeah, no, I absolutely think that weather will. And it breaks my heart, though, to, like you said, because you're talking about people dying,
yes,
right? Because of a problem that we already know about.
but that we have been dragging our feet about for political reasons, right? And I think weather changes too, because for a long time, people are like, oh, maybe this is just an act of God, but it has become this sort of drumbeat, and you have these things that are happening, like flooding in the Midwest, right? Wiping out farms, wiping out livelihoods, and places that never saw flooding like this. They had no idea. They are not built to deal with it. And I think that that's happening, the wildfires. And I think two things come out of the weather that I think really start people thinking about it. The one is the recognition that money and wealth cannot always save you or protect you. So I think you saw that in the wildfires where they took out incredibly wealthy neighborhoods. I watched Real Housewives of Beverly Hills. Two housewives lost their homes out of the six. It was tragic. They'll be fine. But there was this sense, but then there was also the dystopia where you have like the Kardashians hiring private firefighters, right? And so you really see in real time the disparities in America. There are some people who are wealthy enough to hire firefighters to save their home while all of paradise is wiped out. And I think the other side of that is a lot of times people see natural or like these climate events, these natural disasters, for lack of a better word, and they see it as far off. And they think that once it's over, the money goes in, FEMA goes in, it's fixed. And I think as it's spreading and as we're seeing the costs rise and more people are having to live with the aftermath, they see there's no magic wand that gets waved and it's fixed. These things take years to fix. Your FEMA money might not come in for months. People in paradise are still waiting for FEMA trailers, right? People are understanding that like once these things happen, it doesn't, just because you don't see it on the news anymore, it doesn't mean that it stopped affecting you. And I think people are also starting, that also brings up issues where people see how our safety net is so full of holes that you can fall through, and the ways that we have built not only a market economy, but a market society, and the ways that when you fall out of one market, because they overlap, you start falling out of others. You don't have a physical address anymore. How are you applying to a job? Your computer's gone, you can't hire one, you can't buy another one, but your library was gone, so what email are you using? All of these sorts of things that overlap. And I think that that is bringing people to the reality that storms don't just come and end. Storms come and you live in it, right? And I think people are also, so I think that's happening, and I also think that when these things happen, a lot of the costs fall on states and localities who have the least ability to pay. Right, FEMA comes in, but then FEMA leaves. And all those businesses are gone. And so I think people are also realizing that states and localities are having to shoulder more of this burden and looking around and being like, who is helping me with this? And also realizing that when those businesses are gone, they are gone. The Green New Deal is an investment in things. Climate disaster is an erasure of things. Right? And I think that all of that sort of intertwines and plays. And then I think the last thing is people are recognizing that nowhere is particularly safe from the weather. We like to think of coasts, but when you have flooding in the Midwest, that's not a coast, right? D.C., I live in D.C. now. Maryland will have the climate of Mississippi if we don't do anything by the end of the century, right? And so I think people are really starting to recognize and grapple with those things, and the macroeconomic effects, or I should say, the effects on local economies are starting to be seen too, and I think are starting to ripple up, whether you're talking about those farmlands being taken out and where's agriculture taking a hit, harvest season changing, all of that.
Doug, how do you think about the weather?
I think your reading of it's right. I mean, we've had this conversation before. For too long, this was an issue of the elites that was not broadly supported and appreciated. That weather changes that dramatically. The other one that's out there and will increasingly force attention is sea level rise. Because if you look, for example, at the session yesterday on sort of where the economic growth is going to be, it's going to be underwater. And that's a problem. People are going to notice.
Yeah. Okay, questions for you all? I'm happy to see a bunch of hands. We've got mics back there. Let's come back here, right back there. And thanks.
Excuse me. Rihanna, I have not read the 14-page document, so please correct me if I'm wrong. But I heard you talk about childhood asthma in the fragile communities being so high. But and that may be, let's say, 1 in 10 children. But we work with children in those communities that don't learn to read, and perhaps 80% of children in these communities are not reading. That's a fixable situation. Why is that not part of the New Deal?
The Green New Deal? Yeah, I think it's not. Well, because the Green New Deal is focused around an economic mobilization, so despite the fact that people like to think about the second half as just like a complete progressive wish list, the second half is based around what it will take for the economic mobilization to be successful. So it doesn't include K through 12 education because we thought that those issues exist elsewhere. And so when you're talking about, not elsewhere, but there are policies to deal with that. And the K through 12 education is critical, right? It's critical, but in the context of a 10-year mobilization, we thought the priority should be career education, vocational education, and also building up wealth and income in those communities so that those schools are better funded. Of course you can't get to a career if you cannot read, but the Green New Deal cannot include everything, and there should be other policies in place that are responsible for making sure that children can read.
Right, thank you. Just two pieces of news. If anybody's been following the news...
Can I just ask a question?
Certainly. All right, then the question should be, amid recent news of reports, 114 degrees in France yesterday, European heat wave, and proof that shit's getting real, it's so hot in Spain that manure self-ignited, sparking a 10,000-acre fire. That's today's news. Wouldn't you be in favor of throwing support? What wouldn't be prudent for Sunrise and GND supporters to throw their support behind a policy that is not regressive but progressive, that benefits the lower 70% ahead of time, ahead of any prices rising, creates millions of jobs, promotes American ingenuity and competition, lowers the only plan on track with the IPCC insofar as carbon emissions reduction, and it's a bill in Congress now with over 50, well, I think now
Which
53... It's H.R. 763, the Energy Innovation Act. It's energyinnovationact.org if anybody wants to look it up.
Great.
And so even Aspen Skiko...
Let me get her to reply to it.
Right. And this is... let me just say it's designed with equity in mind, so it's not a tax swap.
No,
so what is the bill?
It's the EIA.
And how is it fundamentally different from the Green New Deal?
It's a carbon... It's a version of a carbon tax.
It's a carbon tax.
It's a carbon tax. I think that... I totally get where you're coming from, but again, part of the intervention of the Green New Deal is not just in the policy that we make, but how we make it, and making sure that frontline and vulnerable communities are at the table from the beginning shaping it, and they have grave reservations about a carbon tax. And until we can really get down to the nitty-gritty and talk to them about it, which we have been, but really understand where they're coming from and see if any of these solutions are amenable to sort of the folks that we work with in those spaces, we're not going to move forward. So like it might make sense for the Sunrise and the Green New Deal, but if communities are expressing, just recently US Can has, 13 objections to pricing. They represent a ton of groups. We need to have a conversation. We are not there yet. So I can't commit to that on this stage, but it is certainly something that we talk about, and certainly something that, especially after finding out about the service delivery structure of the EIA, that I have looked at it, and I will be bringing that up and have brought it up.
This is primarily a question for Rihanna. Obviously, we have a highly dysfunctional national government right now, and the chance of this achieving a coalition that would support this is relatively low. Are you looking at working with some of the progressive states that might do this at a state level to create a success story that could then be accelerated to the national level?
Yeah, absolutely. We actually talk to states and localities a lot because states and locals have moved on this problem where the federal government has not because they haven't had a choice in lots of instances. And so we absolutely support state action. And we encourage it, but that's silly. They're not waiting on us to encourage it. But of course we support it. And those models are important to show that these things can be done, that you can structure, right, a retrofitting program that trains local communities, that is encourages a circular economy and money going back into the local community, that you can do this and that it can, you know, be financially feasible, et cetera. So it's crucial. But I think the thing that gets lost is that states have far less ability and flexibility when it comes to raising revenue, right? And so what we've heard even from the most progressive states is we could go this much faster with federal support. These are the places that we can't go with federal support. And so that's why we've been talking much more about federal policy because we know that states can and do move, but without the support of the federal government, what they can do is incredibly constrained.
This in some ways comes back to Doug's initial point about the political success of the Green New Deal harnessing attention, but I actually think there's a pretty good chance that if the Democrats have all three houses of, if they have the presidency, the Senate, and the House, which I think the odds of that are below 50%, but they're not that much below 50%, and if they have all three, I think they can pass something really sweeping. And to me, I don't know, I would guess you do agree with this, but to me, one of the important things about what this Green New Deal discussion has done, I think it would be a tremendous wasted opportunity if the Democrats, the next time they have government, tried to do healthcare again as their first thing. I think Obamacare, whatever you think about it, did a lot. And it strikes me that it would be much better for the Democratic Party to decide that climate was the first priority rather than healthcare or something else. Does it seem plausible to you, Doug, as a kind of outsider watching the Democratic Party, that that they would make climate the first priority when they next have government?
It doesn't strike me as implausible. I guess my fear about the scenario you laid out, not just the fact that they control three branches
yes.
of the government, which of course gave
yes.
me a heart attack.
Yes.
My concern is if it's done in a partisan fashion, it fails. Right? You need to get both parties on board to do something because they won't have all three forever. Republicans will eventually have some say, and it'll be like Obamacare, which was a tragedy in the sense that there's no stability, there's no commitment to the future. It's not genuinely a reform if one party is dedicated to tearing it apart. And that's what was true with Obamacare. That's what's true now with the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act because of the way Republicans did it. And that's not good policymaking. That's not genuine reforms.
But there is an Alice in Wonderland quality here, which is if Republicans refuse to be in favor of any policy that addresses climate change.
That's not quite fair. Let's face it. Only a Republican has had a vote in the Senate. My old boss. There are lots of Republicans who are all in on a variety of innovation bills. They haven't supported a carbon price recently. That's true. I agree with that. And we'll see how fast that can change.
I mean, I think it would be, sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, but we both agree that innovation policy alone won't get us there. So what? I guess and I know that if everyone wants to talk about this dispassionately, but this is the world that I will raise my kids in, right? Like I am not. I guess even if they're all on board for industry, innovation-led policy, if that's not going to solve the problem, what are we talking about? What's the next step to get them further than that then? And I feel like we keep ending up in this space where we talk about having to appeal over partisan lines. And I get that, and I understand the importance of bipartisanship to the durability of policy. But at some point, we have to be moving to solve this problem. Right, and spending time, getting folks to agree to half measures and then refusing to move farther than that, I don't know how that's a good use of time.
To me, it would be enormously productive to start to see, I don't know if this is something your group could do, Doug, but to start to see examples of climate bills that fairly ambitious climate bills that Republican members of Congress have signed on to. And I don't just mean wonks, right? Like if you put you and Gene Sperling, who was just in here in a room, I would love what you guys would come out with on climate change. I also don't think it would get a lot of Republican votes in Congress.
You know, it hasn't so far, but we're seeing, you know, we've got Mitt Romney and a couple others who have carbon tax bills. They're out there now. There is increasing revival of conservative interest in this issue. It went away for about a decade. And it always has been an issue of politics, right? This is not a policy design problem. It's getting the policy to be good politics.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the things that there are two things about that I just would emphasize from the perspective of the folks I talked to on the right. Number one is the international component. They are genuinely concerned about doing something without getting buy-in from the rest of the globe, and then you've spent a lot of money to accomplish exactly nothing. That's the concern. And then the second thing, purely from a climate point of view, I understand you have other objectives. And then the second thing is, and this is what fuels the right-wing populist opposition on this, is this isn't really about the climate. This is about these elites telling me how to live my life. That this is just a way to get at into my life, and I don't want that. Leave me alone. And that's hard to overcome.
I can repeat it if the mic doesn't get you. There we go. We got you.
What is the chance of dealing with climate change and economic equality in the same proposal? I see that as almost impossible.
Well, I mean, we weren't even talking about climate change before in the robust way that we were. Something about the Green New Deal is exciting people. Something, it has broad, support among people, among it polls consistently high. And so I understand that there is, there are political barriers, right? I totally get that, but I also think that we have tried to just tackle climate as climate alone, year after year, decade after decade, and where are we? We are 12 years to get carbon at least 50%, emissions 50% lower than they are now, right? And so what we keep seeing is that fighting on climate alone is not winning us any ground. Like you said, we have to bundle it. We have to grow the pie. We have to, especially, we haven't talked about it, but there's a lot of fossil fuel money that goes to the GOP. The GOP is generally intransigent on climate. So when you have a party like that, unless you have some people power, what is going to happen? And so I think I totally understand the fear. I am 29 years old. I didn't want to spend my time doing this. I have a dog and unlimited carbs to eat. Like what? You know, but the fact is the problems are intertwined. And the other, so I will say that we have tried that. And sometimes I feel like the appeal to just focus on climate is an appeal to feel serious to very serious people. Because if you look at the track record, it is not a winning one. Right? So no one is saying, and the other thing is the Green New Deal, no one's saying that this will be one giant omnibus bill that's pushed through. We're saying that it is a coherent, overarching vision for what our economy should look like and the ways that we should structure this transformation as we go forward. It could be 10 bills, it could be 15 bills, it could be 20 bills, it could be 3 bills. I frankly don't care. And the political calculus around that will come down to the time when it needs to be decided. But right now, we're at a point where we need to figure out how are we going to decarbonize? How are we going to make sure that the economy does not, that it gets better, that we are not at the place that we are right now in 50 years, and we need to decide what power relationships we want to maintain going forward and which ones we want to rearrange, and that is what the Green New Deal is about right now, and I think that is why people are excited about it, and I think we can talk about how to split it up, but it is a generative space right now, so while we are in this generative space, let's generate.
Unfortunately, I'm looking at all zeros on the clock. So I'm going to end with two pieces of advice, which is really just stealing advice from each of you. As Doug said, read the Green New Deal. It's 14 pages. It's not that long. Some of the things you've probably heard about it are not true. Some of the things you've heard about it are true. I bet you'll like some things in it and not like some things, but read it. It doesn't take that long. And the second thing, which is really just parroting off your last point, which is if you are a fan of carbon taxes or cap and trade, I would encourage you to reflect a little bit on why they have failed. I've been spending a lot of time as someone who likes them over the last year trying to do that. To me, those of us who are worried about the climate and who think carbon taxes and cap and trade are elegant solutions, it's not enough to say they're really good solutions. I think we have to think about why they've failed repeatedly, not only in this country, but why they've fared so poorly in other countries as well, and try to come up with a solution for carbon taxes and cap and trade that is either different from what we've been doing or is different from carbon taxes and cap and trade. And on that unusually evangelical note, thank you very much for being here.
This is Aspen Public Radio. You've been listening to a rebroadcast from the Aspen Ideas Festival at the Aspen Institute. You can find this discussion in full later today on our website at aspenpublicradio.org. Support for this broadcast of the Ideas Festival comes from Obermeyer Wood Investment Counsel, an independent investment advisor committed to helping clients navigate life's financial decisions. Learn more about the firm's team and approach at obermeyerwood.com. This is Aspen Public Radio, broadcasting on KAJX 91.5 Aspen and KCJX 88.9 in Carbondale. Your news, your music, your station. Thanks for tuning in, and good morning.
From NPR and